All right, Cargill, let's go get some breakfast. I'm feeling like an Egg McMuffin today. Let's go get some breakfast.
Not this late in the morning. It's like 11:15, dude.
Dude, what are you talking about? They have breakfast all day at McDonald's now.
What are you talking about? They've never done breakfast all day.
What? But I thought... Oh, God. What am I going to... No! What's happening? Oh, thank God. It was just a nightmare. Oh, text Cargill. Hey, Cargill, let's go to McDonald's and get some breakfast. I'm feeling like a McGriddle today. I know they have them all day, so McGriddle it up.
They actually don't have McGriddles anymore.
No!
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Everybody, welcome back to Junk Food Cinema. This is the weekly-ish cult and exploitation film cast that is so good it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, forever a slave to McDonald's breakfast, and I am joined once again by my friend and co-host. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's working on movie things. He's C. Robert Cargill.
Hi. You know what? I'm really happy that you added in that bit. You didn't tell me about that beforehand, but you said, let me text Cargill in that, because the first time you ran through that, I'm like, why in your fantasy am I in your bed? Like that.
I didn't
just
think it all the way through.
You really, and finally you caught it at the end there, because I was just like, that was going to be kind of awkward.
Just roll over and be like,
what kind of friendship do Brian and Cargill have?
Look, we wear a lot of headbands. We watch a lot of Italian post-apocalyptic films with headbands and cod pieces. Things are bound to happen.
Lots of sweaty, you know, beefy guys.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I don't see anything
wrong with
that.
There's nothing wrong with that. If we want to sleep in the same bed and eat McGriddles, and I mean, you shouldn't eat McGriddles in bed. Because
no, that's messy.
The syrup alone, but the crumbs and the syrup together, that's just gross.
You're going to have a bad time. But if you would like to have a good time, what you should do is go back
and... Good time!
Ain't nothing but a good time going back and listening to our cataloged episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ you'll never guess, guys. Oh, that's right. Junk Food Cinema. So it is October, and we are just days away from possibly the greatest holiday on the calendar. I'm, of course, referring to Halloween. My favorite holiday by far. I am so excited every time October rolls around. And this since we are in October, I thought we would cover horror movies, much as I think we did last year. However, I wanted to focus specifically on some underrated horror sequels.
Of the 90s.
Yeah, I guess they both are of the 90s. Yeah, I didn't think about
that. In fact, all but one of them that we chose are of the 90s, because we were going to do a full month, and then all sorts of craziness happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Like super craziness, like stuff you and I both can't talk about, craziness. That is just like, wow, we have really good excuses for why we're late, but we can't tell you. So
you'll have to wait for the tell-all Junk Food Cinema biography to hear all of the lucid details.
You know what we should do? We should actually stop recording Junk Food Cinema and go back and record director's commentaries for all our previous episodes of Junk Food Cinema.
Oh, yeah.
Where we can then tell the behind-the-scenes stories making those episodes.
I remember when Cargill said this, and I was just like, oh, for God's sake, he's bringing that up again. And then I had four more beers, and it didn't matter anymore.
Just didn't matter anymore.
It just didn't. But we'd be drinking during the commentary, so we'd reach like Inception levels of drunk.
It'd be kind of amazing, wouldn't
it? Yeah, it kind of would
be. Like, nobody's really done that yet, have they? Have they done the director's commentaries of their podcasts?
No, I don't think those have been hot ticket items on the internet yet, but they can be. A man can dream. A man can dream.
And speaking of dreams, Segway Master.
Wow, I like that. The Dream Master himself, Fred Krueger, rearing his head for the first of our underrated horror sequel month here at Junk Food Cinema. Now, this kind of serves a double function. I mean, one, this is a great underrated horror sequel that I think deserves a lot of attention. And two, can also serve as our memoriam for, unfortunately, the recently departed Wes Craven. Because I remember when he passed away, he was one of many of our icons that kind of departed us while we were in the middle of a theme month and we couldn't quite work in a retrospective the way we wanted to. But here, everything just kind of fell into place, and we're going to be talking about Wes Craven's new Nightmare.
Nightmares come in different forms, at different times, for different reasons. Now, Wes Craven, the man that knows them better than anyone, is bringing you something new.
From 1994, which is the seventh in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, and probably my favorite of the whole franchise, and I include the first one with
Whoa.
That. Yeah, because there's
that's a bold statement.
I thought about this a lot because I revisited it a couple times over this most recent weekend, and I think there's just so much about this movie that operates on a level even above what he was able to accomplish in 1984 with the first one.
Yeah, well, this film has a really interesting place in history, both in Wes Craven's history and in cinema history, because this is, and horror history particularly, because this is really kind of the end of the slasher era. Like, this was the final nail in the coffin of the slasher era. This, you know, from this point on, Wes Craven stopped making these and moved on into the next movement. In fact, creating the next movement.
Yeah.
He both made the last movie of an era and the first movie of its next era.
And he made the hilariously, the sort of tentpole movie of the copycat era of the era he just ended.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really kind of crazy. So there's so much going on in the meta of a meta movie.
Yeah.
Because it's not a movie as much as it's a meta movie. It's so fucking batshit crazy pants of a movie that I get why it didn't connect with audiences at the time. And audiences, of course, were shifting radically at the time. But it is one that is really worth revisiting because it is a really cool, special kind of fucking movie.
Yeah, I mean, he basically looked at the franchise as it stood and thought, you know, this has gotten really far away from what I had intended with the first one and what I did with the first one. And what he does is I can't think of a filmmaker that did this before him. And it sounds strange to talk about now in the era of, like, you know, Joss Whedon and all of these, like, super, and you know, even what kind of Quentin Tarantino was evolving into, and all of these really sort of introspective, inner-gazing sort of
self-referential
filmmakers. But he decided, let's stop making the movies about the characters and make the movies about the actors who play. So actors who play these characters, in essence, immediately acknowledging that they are fiction. And creating a fiction out of the reality, and which is such a bold and brilliant thing to do, and he makes it work, and he makes it work despite the fact that there's not really a heck of a lot of exemplar to cull from when doing. I mean, he's really in uncharted territory when it comes to doing something like this.
Yeah, you know, let's start from the beginning. This movie is often listed as New Nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more widely referred to as Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And I think it's essential to call the movie, as you did, Wes Craven's New Nightmare. Because that's what the movie actually is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not just a credit. That's not just Wes Craven kind of patting himself on the back. Like, when you get to the heart of what this movie's actually about at its plot
it's
level...
It's Wes Craven having a nightmare.
It's Wes Craven having a new nightmare.
It's really kind of strange. So for those of you that aren't familiar with it, The Nightmare on Elm Street series, well, let's start with that. You know, starts out with what is, for its era, an iconic film. A film that comes out during the slasher era, just when slasher eras are going from a guy in a mask into supernatural boogeymen.
Mm.
And that's what people want. People want boogeymen. And, you know, all of a sudden, we have this guy, this crazy fucking monster that there's no running from. We can't not sleep.
Yeah.
We will always fall asleep and he will always catch up with us.
You can stay out of Haddonfield, you can stay out of Jason's Woods, you can't stay awake forever.
Yeah. So there's this whole new kind of concept that gets you when you're out of the movie. And it's so brilliant. It was just fundamentally brilliant on its level. And then there's a really crazy kind of sequel that was really hated at the time and people are just starting to come around on. Because the subtext of the film was not acceptable in the 80s and was laughable and is now highly acceptable.
I would call it supertext more than subtext because it's not subtle at all with that message.
Yeah, but then we get into the third one, which is arguably the best of the series. Whether it's your favorite or not, you know, it is the one that is most beloved of the sequels in particular, and structurally is kind of better than the first. And then the fourth one starts, and from that point on, we begin the downward slide into suckdom.
Yeah. Where thanks, Rennie Harlan.
Yeah, the sequels just start getting worse and worse because by this point, Freddy has been allowed to move away from the scary nightmare man and turn into a joke.
Yeah.
And he's a jokester, and it's all about Schwarzenegger-esque one-liners while slaughtering teenagers.
The punning man.
Yeah. That is exactly what this fucking is. And that's unfortunately what it becomes. Now, there's some really cool scenes in each one of the sequels. Yeah. Each one of the sequels has something neat about it.
They've all got their moments.
But on the whole, each one gets progressively worse until they finally kill off the series with Freddy's Dead. The 3D version, which just is
3D-ish. Like 2.5D.
I did see it in 3D.
That's too bad.
In the theater. I've told you about this because I kept my glasses for years and they advertised Suburban Commando on the side. And it's that kind of era of filmmaking. So this franchise is over, but they're not done milking the franchise. And this is how crazy this is to think about in retrospect. When you're watching this film, the seventh film, Bob Shea, the head of New Line at the time, is in it as himself and is talking about the fact that we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of Nightmare. And it's like, they've made 7 films
in 10 years.
Of this franchise. Jesus fuck. I mean, they were really cranking them out at the end. So you have this film that now has run its course over the course of Boogeymen. So we started out where Boogeymen are awesome. And now by the end, we've sent Jason to Manhattan. We've sent Michael Myers direct to video.
Yep.
Oddly, and this is a small little thing, we'll get to that next week. But oddly, Michael Myers is sent direct to video. Hellraiser starts getting inexplicably worse to the point that we get to an era where we've run out of places to go and we started sending our B-list monsters into space.
Yep.
If you're a leprechaun, if you're a Cenobite, you're going to fucking space.
And the most egregious example of that, by the way, Critters. You know why that's egregious? Because they fucking came from space. Sending a crite back to space is not a gimmick. Okay, that's like going, this time Jason's in the woods. Motherfucker, he came from the woods. If you're really going to reach for gimmicks, you got to reach a little further than that.
And so here we are at the end of this era. And what we're looking at when this movie was made was this was, as I've talked about in the past, many of you have heard about the pendulum of the fantastic versus the realistic. This is at the very, very end of the Hollywood era where genre's finally catching up with everything else in Hollywood. People are tired of fantasy, of the fantastic. They want something more realistic. They want something gritty and raw. Independent film is exploding on the scene. All of a sudden, the biggest films that are coming out are by these young Turk directors like Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino and Richard Linklater and Kevin Smith. And all of a sudden, this whole big budget concept of making movies is just stupid and people are getting tired of it. And the whole era is just riddled with some bad cinema. And so here's Wes Craven, a horror master, going, I actually have a fresh idea. And the fresh idea is, what if we go meta with the movie and make a movie about the monster that Freddy Krueger really was, that was behind the inspiration of it, that behind the original nightmare I had that made Nightmare on Elm Street. And we have the cast and crew dealing with that monster coming up, wanting another movie to be made so that he can scare audiences again and get into their heads. And it's such a cool fucking concept.
And it really does. I want to go back to something you mentioned about Dream Warriors and how it's arguably the best of the sequels. What we've talked about this a number of times, about how all these great movies came out at the wrong time and just missed their audience. And I think something that accidentally was very fortuitous for Wes Craven is that this movie, New Nightmare, started off as a proposed script for Dream Warriors. And New Line said no. New Line didn't like the idea, and they turned it down. And then you jump forward a few more years to Peter Jackson's take on Freddy's Dead. We've talked about that on the show before. Peter Jackson's script for Freddy's Dead was about Freddy Krueger having become such a laughingstock because of the way the sequels had been going and him becoming a joke, that the entity itself had become a joke, and kids in Elm Street were like going into their dreams to fuck with him. Like, he was this like downtrodden, put upon homeless person in Dreamland. And so you have like these attempts to do exactly what New Nightmare does, to step back one dimension and have the artist looking at the portrait and taking that inward perspective, that don't get off the ground just because we weren't ready yet. And I think that's what's so interesting about this finally getting made and coming out exactly when it did, is that Wes Craven is able to do something that I am always fascinated by in films, no matter the genre, is explore the relationship between creator and creation. And when that's done in a horror movie, I think it's especially powerful, because, I mean, that goes back all the way to Mary Shelley. I mean, that is a core tenet of horror, is the idea of what we create ending up being the thing that destroys us. And I love the way that that's explored in New Nightmare. When we find, I mean, the basic premise of the movie is that Heather Langenkamp, who is, of course, Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street, is being, she has a stalker. A lot of weird things start happening, all kind of centered around this upcoming anniversary of Nightmare on Elm Street. And she keeps running into people, you know, like Robert Englund and, of course, Bob Shea, like all these different people she worked with on
John
the original. John fucking Saxon. God love John Saxon. And just all of these, she's having
these two roles in this movie,
who expertly plays two roles in this movie. And, you know, and she's just, and again, the nightmares have started up for her, and it's starting to become a problem because she's a mother and her son is experiencing some night terrors and some other weird, unexplained behavior. And she's trying to put all the pieces together. And here's why I think this movie works so well. And again, why timing is so important to film. The meta aspect of this movie goes far beyond the characters from that groundbreaking horror film in 84. Heather Langenkamp actually did have a stalker. That's something that was inserted into this script when Wes Craven found out about it. Another thing is that in the original script, as in the film, there are all these earthquakes that are taking place that are sort of the kind of the idea of sort of the fabric between reality and fiction are starting to clash together. Just so happens, right when they started shooting, the Northridge earthquake happens. Like, one of the most powerful earthquakes that, like, any urban city has ever experienced. So there's footage in this movie of the destruction from the earthquakes that are happening in the film that is actual Northridge footage. So again, it's like, it is life imitating art, art imitating life, however you want to break that down, in the most odd way possible, and something that I think culminates into the perfect meta experiment. And I think it was definitely huge for Wes Craven, considering what he would do with his very next movie.
Well, with his several next movies, in which this is the beginning of Wes Craven's meta era.
Yeah.
He had kind of done everything he could in regular fiction for a while, and then moved on into the meta.
Yeah.
And so not only, though, is this a meta film, like what would happen next, which I'll get to that in a minute, actually. There's something I want to talk about. But not only is it a meta movie, but you can actually see a number of the same motifs that he would then use in Scream, Scream 2, Scream 3. In fact, just recently, you and I were at Fantastic Fest's Fantastic Feud.
Yeah.
And one of the questions was, how many times does a phone ring?
I knew you were going to say that. I noticed that same thing watching New Nightmare. I'm like, there's a phone ringing every 5 seconds in this movie.
Yeah. No, and the phone ringing is used as tension,
mm-hmm.
which it's used in tension in Scream.
Yeah.
This is where he first starts really playing around with this. I mean, it was something that he's dealt with in several of his films, and it was something that goes all the way back to the first Nightmare. You know, one of the things this film does is it reuses a number of the elements, the horror elements from Nightmare on Elm Street, and reuses them and repurposes them here. But the phone was important there, but the phone becomes a major piece here that then also becomes a piece in the Scream film.
It's the first sound you hear in Scream. Yeah. When the title card comes up, it's the first thing you hear.
And of course, everybody in the audience is like, oh God, how many could there be? And everybody's like, I think it's 49 times. And people are like, I think it's 65 times. I think it's 70 times. Motherfucker, in the four films, 180 something times the phone goddamn rings.
Jesus.
And so that's what it feels like here at times, because the whole thing with the stalker, that's what the ringing phone is. The ringing phone is it the stalker? And is it really a stalker, or is it Freddy Krueger?
Yeah.
You know, and if it's not Freddy Krueger, what is it? And that's something that's played with here. Also, a lot of the cinematography he uses here is the beginning of what we would see in Scream. The cinematography in Scream is a little slicker than it is here, and defined the entire era from 96 on to the early aughts of mm-hmm. horror. Because what happened after Scream was virtually every horror film didn't have a monster. It was a teenager or somebody angry coming and killing a bunch of teenagers. But it was always shot in the slick style that was ripped off from Craven. And here he's playing around with some of those techniques. And if you look at New Nightmare visually, it is, you can see where Craven is going with his style that would evolve into the Scream style that then would evolve into the entire horror style of an entire era.
And that's what's crazy to me, is that when you think about all the copycat movies, the I Know What You Did Last Summers and so on and so forth, that came out after
Disturbing Behaviors, Disturbing H2O,
all of these movies that came out as a direct result of Scream, that don't realize that they're basically making a copy of a copy, so to speak. I mean, it's Scream is a movie that is basically deconstructing the entire genre, the entire slasher genre. And then to have a resurgence of slasher films come out as a result of that is really hilarious to me.
Did you, out of curiosity, see that short film that played at Fantastic Fest about the potential origin of Scream?
No.
There's a great short film that somebody made that essentially they go and tell this story about this film that is floating around out there that you can find called There's Nobody Out There. And it was a film made in 1989 that had a terrible history. But essentially, it was this low budget, like $250,000 movie this screenwriter made, in which it's about a bunch of guys, a bunch of teenagers who go out into the woods to a cabin. And then horror stuff starts happening. But one of the guys in the group is actually a hardcore movie nerd and is realizing that all of these things are cliches from horror movies
mm-hmm.
and is trying to outthink whatever's going on, because clearly they're in a horror movie.
Yeah.
And they have to play by horror movie rules. And at a key point in the movie, then breaks down and explains to everyone, look, we're in a horror movie. These are the horror movie rules. Play by this and you will survive. And it was called There's Nobody Out There because it was one of the most cliched lines in a horror movie ever, where it's like, knock, knock, knock. What is it? Somebody's out there. There's nobody out there.
Jamie Lee Curtis says it to Tommy in Halloween.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then this guy went, you know, the movie came out. It was, you know, famously came out on the weekend. You know, it was in a limited release that would then be blown up to a wider release. So it played on 10 screens in New York and L.A. On the weekend of the L.A. riots.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, after a dismal performance.
There's nobody in that theater is where there's nobody.
So So the movie got yanked, but it had been passed around. Hollywood people had seen it, really liked it, wanted to work with this guy. And one of the guys was a producer who really liked the film and did a couple of lunch meetings with this writer slash director and wanted to do something with him. And then nothing ever came of it. And this guy happened to be Wes Craven's son.
Oh, wow.
And then here, a few years after that, Wes Craven makes a movie that is, some argue, is practically beat for beat this film, There's Nobody Out There, which also borrows from Wes Craven's own previous movie by going really meta. Mm-hmm. And here, he's going so meta that his own actors and he himself and Bob Shea and people who work at New Line, and like there's so many filmmakers in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Playing themselves, although not credited as playing themselves, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Normally, you know, it would be Heather Loggenkamp as herself, and it's Heather Loggenkamp as Heather Loggenkamp,
yeah,
because it's not actually herself.
Right.
It's one of the interesting meta notions.
Like slightly fictionalized versions of themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I find really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
That they're not even calling it as himself. As herself, because no, she's playing the character Heather Loggenkamp,
right,
who has a husband in a special effects company who dies in the first act of the movie.
Whose actual husband, by the way, Heather Loggenkamp's actual husband is a special effects technician. Like, there's a lot about it's funny, like, yeah, obviously there's a lot of things that are fictionalized so that the movie works, but there's also a lot of biographical information in this movie. In fact, like, I was joking to myself as I was watching this that when Bob Shea gets that phone call that nobody answers in his office, I'm like, that's probably Richard Stanley on the set of Island of Dr. Moreau. Like, everything's going to shit, and Val Kilmer is impossible to work with, and I'm just like, that's...
Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh,
like, I imagine that it's...
Just oh, my God, that scene has a completely different meaning for me.
As soon as he picks up that phone, it's like, it's that fucking Island of Dr. Moreau guy again, isn't it? Oh,
my God.
All right, fine.
Yeah, for those of you out there who don't get that joke, you need to see Lost Souls.
You really do. You really
that
do.
That documentary is fucking genius.
It is. I want to talk about the opening scene of this film. We mentioned how the opening scene of Scream is kind of almost... In fact, I want to... Really, really quickly, that phone sound, the sound of every ringing phone in Scream is the exact same as every ringing phone in New Nightmare. Yeah. Like, the pitch doesn't even change.
He uses the exact same sound effect.
Yeah, and in 2 years, phone technology had not changed, evidently.
Well, no, in 2 years, no, but the thing is that he particularly likes that pitch and timbre of that phone because there's an ominousness to it.
There is a bit of an ominousness to it, but... New Nightmare's opening is really interesting because it has tinges of the opening of the very first Nightmare on Elm Street, and you see the glove being made, and you see the knives being added to it. There are no credits on the screen whatsoever, which was intentional, so that that line again between, you know, reality and fiction is blurred. But then you realize that the glove is being made not by Krueger, but as a prop in a movie. They're shooting a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And what I think is interesting is that a lot of the movie that they're shooting, Wes Craven is directing, so he's there on set directing, and a lot of the props as they kind of walk through the movie set are either red or green. So they look like Freddy's sweater. Like, there's all these little things, and then you figure out, oh, well, based on the events that happen on that set, it's like, okay, well, that was a dream. And this is a recurring thing. And if you've seen any of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, the whole, like, is this person awake? Are they in a dream? It happens here quite a bit. But the thing that gets added to that I thought was really brilliant is there's a scene where Heather Loggenkamp is talking to John Saxon. And this is after a number of things have been going wrong. Her son Dylan is exhibiting this weird behavior. She's not sure what's going on. She starts to talk to John Saxon for a moment about mental illness in her family and schizophrenia in her family. And it's the way it's edited is so brilliant because you're not paying attention to her. You're paying attention to Dylan climbing up on top of this playground equipment, like, dangerously high, and the tension of that. You're like, no, what? Hey, somebody notice the kid. So you're not entirely listening to what she says. But what she's doing is she's adding this kernel of doubt that anything is really going on. So in addition to the waking versus sleeping visions. You know, is she awake? Is she asleep? What is she? There's this subtle doubt put in the audience's mind that maybe Heather Langenkamp is fucking crazy. Maybe, in fact, none of this stuff is happening in either the dream world or the real world, and that Heather Langenkamp might just be losing her mind, which I think is a really interesting, it obviously doesn't turn out to be the case, but it's a really interesting little twist in the narrative to kind of just poke at the audience a little bit.
But to go back to that opening scene that you were talking about, mm-hmm. the set on which they're filming is the set from the final sequence of the movie. That what they're walk, you know, where mm-hmm. what the movie that they're shooting the final scenes that are the finale of this film.
Yeah, yeah. The very again, the sort of furnace world that Freddy Krueger has long been established to live in, kind of tempered with, and they mention this as a motif throughout the movie, like the Hansel and Gretel witch story, which is really fascinating. But I love the idea that Wes Craven is not going to allow the audience to get a firm grasp on exactly what is going on, because it just the sense of disorientation throughout the whole movie is so palpable. And I hadn't really noticed that until this particular viewing. Like, yeah, he intentionally creates this sort of reasonable doubt that our narrator may not, or not, well, I guess you could say our narrator, even though she's not narrating, our narrator is unreliable, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, here's another thing about the narrator being unreliable that I find interesting, just a small little nugget. The scene when she goes and sees Wes.
Oh, yeah.
At his home. Wes does not come across as a very good actor.
Not great, no.
No. There's a lot of ums. There's a lot of him, like, kind of trying to seem like he's thinking.
Yeah.
But there's a subtle genius to that, that I don't know how intentional this is or if it just ends up this way, but Wes has been writing the script that is becoming real, and everything Wes says on the couch, he's just typed into his computer.
Yeah.
And so what he's really doing is sitting there trying to remember what he's supposed to say from the script.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's
and it's so when you watch it and knowing that, it's kind of, there's a whole other level to this performance that is either accidental and awesome or just fucking brilliant.
Yeah. And he does that throughout the movie.
Yeah. Because this whole, he's writing the horror film as she's in it. And he asks her if she will play the part one more time. And she thinks she's going to have to go and make the movie after he's done writing the script in order to kill Freddy Krueger, not realizing that the script he's writing is going to force her into the dream world where she's going to be Nancy in the dream world, yeah. Which is where we get that brilliant scene with John Saxon, where all of a sudden John Saxon, who's been this delightful, cuddly actor friend who she's known for a decade and a half.
Yeah.
This kind of fatherly figure.
Confidant, yeah.
Confidant, talking to her and walking her through it and being there for her, all of a sudden is just being a dick and is just like, you need to get your shit together and what are you doing? And, you know, you're going crazy. Don't do that. You're just like your mother.
Yeah.
And at that moment, it's like, wait, what?
It's like, John, what'd you say? And he's like, why are you calling me John?
Well, but no, but before that, he turns and he's standing next to the cop car.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's that great moment of, holy shit, he's not John Saxon anymore. He's the dad from the first fucking movie.
And his wardrobe has changed so that it's the exact same wardrobe from Nightmare on Elm Street. And so is hers.
Yes. And all of a sudden, she realizes, oh, fuck. And she starts to play along and yeah. She realizes this is what Wes meant. Now she has to be Nancy again.
Yeah.
And she has to go into the dream world as Nancy and beat Freddy for the third and final time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting the things that they choose to kind of revisit as far as like the death on the ceiling, the sort of marshmallowy staircase, the phone that licks her, like all these little moments.
Yeah, the babysitter, the blonde babysitter who gets dragged up the wall and killed on the ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's so many of those elements.
Screw your hall pass. All of these little callbacks that happen.
Stretchy arm.
Stretchy
arm.
Did
you mention stretchy arm already?
I did not mention stretchy arm. That's correct.
Like every from the first film. And that's just it, though. He only draws from the first film. He never dips into the sequels.
No.
He only goes from the things from the very first movie.
Which makes sense if we're talking about the relationship between creator and creation. Only the first one is Wes Craven's creation.
Exactly.
And there's a really subtle moment too at one point where she's in bed and you think that they might ape the whole like fabric wall shot where it looks like Freddy Krueger's coming through the wall. And so you're looking at that spot on the wall, and if you're not paying attention, you may not notice the fact that all of the paintings and her side tables are subtly moving back and forth as if she's on a ship. It's like this really interesting, like, immediately you know that reality is just checked out. But it's just such a neat little, like, he's still doing that, but even as he's calling back to himself, he's finding new ways to kind of get that sense of dread and that sense of disorientation across. And I like the idea that Freddy Krueger is something that existed before Wes. Wes is just kind of the story. He mentions how storytellers are sometimes the only thing that can, like, trap this thing that's been around forever, for a little while. It can trap it and kind of keep it complacent. And that's kind of what he says that the whole Nightmare on Elm Street franchise has been. But there's an even more meta aspect to that when you think about where the inspiration for the first Nightmare on Elm Street came from, which was a story about someone who escaped the Cambodian genocide of Pol Pot, who was living with a family in the States and never wanted to sleep. Just didn't, like, they couldn't explain it. He never wanted to sleep. And finally, one night, he was asleep, and the family heard him just screaming, and they came up and he was thrashing around and died in the middle of this horrible nightmare. And when they went into his closet, they found all these like caffeine pills and a tiny little coffee pot. And like, he had been terrified to go to sleep because of the severity of his nightmares. And that's what gave Wes Craven the idea for Nightmare on Elm Street in the first place. So the creation of the movie, of the very first film in the real world, kind of feels like the passing of the torch of something really horrible that already existed. And so the story of this movie about how Wes is like, I have to do this or that thing is going to get out again, just seems even more appropriate. Just seems even more meta. Like, it just keeps on going. Not to mention the fact that we haven't really talked about the change in design, the change in mood, the change in just overall presence of this Freddy Krueger as opposed to previous Freddy Kruegers.
Well, I mean, as we mentioned, they cut out all the jokes.
They cut out all the jokes.
He does not joke at all in this movie. Like, there's no puns. There's no, I'm getting one up on you. It's all, everything he says is meant to terrify someone because he feeds off fear.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, no, but they've specifically redesigned him physically.
Yeah.
Which, love it or hate it, it's different. I feel that his new nightmare look is a little too rubbery for my taste. It's a little more rubbery than some of the other designs. Some of the others have a moistness to them that is just kind of icky and sticky.
To me, this is the Uber Freddy. You know, we
Das Uber Freddy.
Das Uber Freddy. I mean, we're both fans of Jason X. And there's a scene in Jason X where he becomes, and it's credited in the actual fucking credits, Uber Jason. And I feel like New Nightmares Freddy is the Uber Freddy.
Yeah.
I like the bulky, like, I get what you're saying about the rubberiness, but I like that he's bigger. He's, like, bulkier. It looks like he's been hitting the clear and the cream. But I also love the fact that he's just nastier. And it's not even a lack of jokes so much. It's just, like, there's just something colder. There's something more sinister about him, and I really like, and I like the fact that you have Robert Englund in the movie.
You realize we're not allowed to use that word on this podcast.
Well, I know. No.
Like, I've had to remove that word from my vocabulary entirely because everybody's like, oh.
Well, I didn't say
sinister.
I didn't say he was darker and sinister two-ear. so I thought it would be fine. But the thing about it is, like, he
available on piracy websites.
Yeah, go for it. Why not? He's so much more present, and he's so much more, like you said, he's feeding off of that fear so much more. And I like the fact that you have Robert Englund, the actor, playing himself, and then you have Robert Englund at one point in the movie in the makeup playing Freddy Krueger, and then throughout the rest of the movie you have Robert Englund himself terrified of this other version of Freddy Krueger that he is also playing.
That may or may not have killed him in the course of the movie.
Yeah, because he disappears. He vanishes, and apparently there's a scene excised from the movie where Robert Englund has his own Freddy Krueger nightmare, which is, like, I read about a couple of the other scenes they cut, and I can completely understand the whole idea of Wes Craven running from whatever this entity is by like living in a van driven by Michael Berryman was also a scene apparently cut out of this movie, which I totally understand why that got cut. But yeah, I kind of want to see what Robert Englund's Freddy Krueger nightmare looks like. That would be a level of meta that would delight me to no end. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting small little thing. Unlike many of the, you know, other nightmares, almost every other Nightmare on Elm Street has an early appearance by important actors in the genre. Like almost every single Nightmare on Elm Street has like a first performance or a very early performance of some big kind of epic titanic actor right back to the beginning where you've got Johnny Depp in the first one. Someone.
Okay. I feel like I've heard that name before.
Yeah. You may have. I have an aside. I have a Johnny Depp aside. I ran into him in Los Angeles recently.
Well, where else would you run into him?
Yeah. Yeah. but yeah, you know, you got Patricia Arquette in the early ones. You got Lawrence Fishburne. You know, you've got all these great actors before they like blew up.
Like Breckin Meyer was in one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. No. In this one, you don't.
There's, almost by design, I feel.
It's all people, except there's one person with a small walk-on role that would become someone who has now earned herself a place in horror history.
Lynn Shay?
Lynn Shay. And her character title, one of the only people in the movie not to have a name, she is Nurse with Pills.
Nurse with Pills.
Nurse with Pills. Lynn Shay shows up here in a small role. Like, all these other nurses get these big roles, and who plays the small walk-on role? Someone who would then go on to become super important in the Insidious franchise. So somebody who is now probably going to spend the rest of her life doing horror movies and being well regarded as an icon of horror.
And even that was a callback because she was in the first Nightmare on Elm Street too. So it was her like basically like showing up again. Like there's a lot
as
of little
a walk-on.
Moments, as a walk-on. Like there's a lot of little moments like that throughout this movie. And yeah, no, Lynn Shay, I think Nurse with Pills is a better credit than Nurse with Producer Brother. But yeah, no, I mean, she became a staple. She's Bob Shay's sister.
In case you didn't catch that.
But yeah, there's a lot of things like that throughout the course of like I actually like the screw your pass line in this better than I did in the original film. So that's something for sure. And, you'll notice like there's a funeral scene in this movie where a couple of the actors like Tuesday Night, and the guy that played kind of the greaser boyfriend from the first one are just kind of there.
Yeah.
They don't speak. There's no interaction with it. They're just kind of there.
They just show up.
And apparently, funny story, Johnny Depp was just never asked because Wes Craven was too nervous, didn't think he'd want to do it. And then he ran into him after the movie had been released, and Johnny was like, oh, no, I totally would have done that. I would have shown up in that funeral scene. And it's like, what? Come on, man. That would have been great.
That would have, but that's one of those things where that you run into that in Hollywood where, you know, and I've run into this in the past where it's like, hey, well, what about this? And they're like, yeah, they'll never take our call. They'll ask for too much money. They're going to say no. So let's just move on and fix this now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just how it is. And so he was just, it's one of those things where somebody probably said, yeah, no, Johnny's doing too well right now. There's no way he's going to take your call, Wes. Why even embarrass yourself? Why get into the thing where he's going to ask us for $50,000 to show up for one day of shooting? And we can't afford that on this budget. So you know what, Wes, just don't back us into that corner to have to tell Johnny Depp, we can't afford you. So let's just avoid that argument right now. And only to find out that, hey, by the way, yeah, no, Johnny Depp's really fucking cool and would totally show up.
Yeah.
So here, let me take a little aside before we wrap this up.
Let's do it.
So I'm in Los Angeles.
No, you're not. You were.
I was. Okay. There I was in the Congo. I'm in Los Angeles. I'm checking out of my hotel and I'm sitting there in the hotel and I look over to the side and I'm standing next to Johnny Depp. And I'm like, shit, the fuck is Johnny Depp doing at my hotel? Like, I'm not at like a super 8 or anything, but I'm like, this isn't where Johnny Depp comes to stay. What the, the fuck is Johnny? Oh my god, that's not Johnny Depp. No, it's somebody trying very hard to look like Johnny Depp.
Oh my god, did you run into Skeet Ulrich?
Christian Slater. no, but then, so I turn and I'm like, okay, whatever. And I turn and I'm heading towards the bar because I'm going to meet a friend for coffee. And there's Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson is sitting over on the couch. And I'm like, what the fuck is Jack Nicholson doing? That's, oh wait, that's not Jack Nicholson. And he's sitting next to not Patrick Warburton. And I come around the corner and there's a guy in a crushed red velvet suit with black glasses dressed as Austin Powers. And at this point, I know, okay, something very weird is going on here. And for a moment,
what was in that coffee?
For a minute there, I'm like, this is one of those weird fucking dreams. And then I look around and the entire bar is filled with impersonators. Every single seat is taken up by an impersonator of every kind of celebrity you can imagine. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? I'm about to lose my goddamn monkey mind when in behind me, this guy with a headset walks in and goes, okay, everybody, that's a wrap. We're going to drive you back to the studio and break for lunch, and then we'll get you all back together. And everybody just stands up all at once. And Austin Powers goes, has anyone seen my script? And I'm like, oh, thank God.
Script for what? Wait, no. No. That's not a, okay, this all makes sense now moment. That's a, I have more questions moment.
No, there might be questions, but like, it could be a commercial. It could be an indie film. It could be something. I don't know, but at least I know I wasn't out of my goddamn mind and I was surrounded by celebrity impersonators.
Thank you all for coming to Rich Little Con. Really happy to have you here.
But that's not a way you want to wake up on a Friday morning.
No, I don't want to wake up to that ever.
Because I was hungover. I'd been out to a karaoke bar with a good friend, and we had the time of our lives, and it was wonderful. And I wake up with a throbbing hangover. I'm like, I got to get out of here. I've got stuff to do today. And that's how I run into not Johnny Depp. And it is the weirdest. It is one of the weirdest moments I've ever experienced in my life where I literally questioned everything I thought I knew about the nature of reality.
See, if I were a celebrity and I heard about something like that going on, I would go show up at that hotel lobby.
Just to fuck with them.
Just to fuck with people like, oh man, you're a really good John Malkovich. And it's really John Malkovich.
You're a great John Malkovich. Oh, thank you very much. I just can't do the voice yet.
Hold on. You'd be like,
John
Malkovich. You're even doing...
Holy shit, you're so good.
You're even doing a bad accent like John Malkovich always does. That's great.
Malkovich! Yeah, but that's a 100% true story. It's the weirdest fucking... It's one of the weirdest fucking moments of my life. And it just happened last week. And so dealing with Wes Craven, you know, dealing with Nightmare Worlds and Johnny Depp all together, I felt that was a story I needed to share with you guys. So thank you for indulging me.
Yeah.
And now back to your regularly scheduled program discussing a long-forgotten genre film.
This film, New Nightmare, does have, I will say, is not without its flaws. I think a lot of them have to do with the special effects available in
the
era.
Very 1994.
Very 1994. There's one moment in particular where...
The clouds?
The clouds, and really kind of the whole freeway sequence has a lot of iffy moments for me.
It's very blue screen.
Yeah, and it, like, especially when he's like picking up the kid and like dangling him over cars, it's like, yeah, okay, that doesn't look like anything.
But that's forgivable.
But it's totally forgivable because it's a brilliant idea that I think is executed very well. I think there's a lot of moments of this film that stand on their own as being entirely creepy. And then there are other moments that are just so beautifully referential to not only the original Nightmare on Elm Street, but kind of what Wes Craven had created. And it really is the movie where he's basically working out all the kinks for Scream, where he's auditioning himself to see if that's something that he can do. And sure enough, it works so well that he's able to reinvigorate an entire subgenre in his next film by simply being that referential toward it. I mean, really, the character of Randy in Scream is sort of the Wes Craven mouthpiece. I mean, he's the character that serves as doing exactly what Wes Craven, the character, the person, is doing in New Nightmare. And I just think it works on so many levels and is so enjoyable. And to me, I think that's why it, just by a hair, just by the most glimmering tip of one middle finger claw, surpasses the original, because it not only succeeds in what it's doing, but it succeeds in doing something that, you know, we had largely never seen before. And yeah, it's definitely my favorite one to revisit, if nothing else.
My issue with it is that it's so meta and so interesting in that regard that it ceases to be scary. And I don't find this nearly as scary as 1 or 3. It just doesn't, the horror of it seems to be removed because it's being so meta, it's forcing us to be meta about how meta it is. And it pulls us out just enough that as a horror film, it's just not scary. And it wasn't when it came out, which is what really kind of put the final nail in the coffin of the series, which was, oh yes, Freddy's just not scary anymore. Yeah. Although one of the things I've loved about this movie and always loved about this movie was the fact that this weird dream world that Freddy lives in and the way it's portrayed here, I've always seen it as kind of a sub pocket dimension of the hell that the Cenobites live in.
Yeah.
And have always seen Freddy from this point on as being one, being a Cenobite, kind of, whether he be a rogue Cenobite or whether he be a Cenobite from a different, you know, area. But he's always struck me as, like, this is the movie that bridges this with Hellraiser and puts them in a very similar mythology.
When a Cenobite falls asleep just before the kick is administered, this is the dream world they plunge into, is where we find this sort of darker version of Freddy Krueger. And I actually find it, I find this Freddy Krueger, this movie, scarier than most of the sequels, because I just think that version of Freddy Krueger, that kind of mythic dream wraith, is just so intense. Like when he's coming up through the blanket in the middle of the bed, and just like that, and the way that the kind of ties into the stalker, like I find that it's scary on a different level, but definitely certainly very frightening. So yeah, highly recommend New Nightmare. If you haven't seen it already, if you gave up on the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise after a couple sequels, I don't blame you. But what I can tell you is that New Nightmare is a brilliant film, and really does stand the test of time for the vast majority of the film. Which brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And this week, it comes to us courtesy of the company Topps, which you may remember as being one of the, I don't even think they're around anymore, but they made baseball cards predominantly.
I think they were absorbed by Upper Deck, I want to say, years ago.
They got Upper Decked. It's always a bad thing to have happen.
Upper Decker.
When you have an Upper Decker.
MacGruber!
One of the things that Wes Craven really took issue with all the sequels is how silly Freddy Krueger had gotten. And, you know, this movie even kind of pokes fun at all the merchandising that went on with Freddy Krueger. And New Line Cinema is often called the house that Freddy built because of all the money they made, not only off of these sequels, but off of all the merchandising. And one of the weirdest ones for me that I was researching is Freddy's bubblegum. It's not any different from regular bubblegum, except that it has Freddy Krueger's face on it, and I think each pack came with like a Freddy Krueger trading card. And the idea of a Freddy Krueger candy and Freddy Krueger trading cards is really just kind of the epitome of everything that Wes Craven found wrong with his franchise, you know, when he finally came back to it and did New Nightmare. So it kind of, to me, serves as the catalyst or the representative of the catalyst of why Wes Craven came back in the first place. And, you know, if nothing else, New Nightmare, with all of its meta-ness and all of its introspection and all of its self-referential nature, gave us a lot to chew on. So, Freddy's bubblegum, ladies and
gentlemen. But if you can't find that, go out and get yourself a nice baked good and have a Freddy Krueger.
Have a Freddy Krueger. Put one on each finger. Why not? You'll look ridiculous, but you'll know why
but
you're
so
doing
delicious.
It. So delicious.
Lady fingers. My God, they taste like lady fingers.
That sounds like a Freddy Krueger joke. Like he would cut off some chick's finger and be like, oh, good, lady fingers. And he would dip
That's
it in
actually,
tea.
There's like 12 people out there who are like, oh, my God, I've read that Stephen King story. It's literally the last line of a Stephen King story.
Oh, that's adorable. Thank you for joining us this week for Junk Food Cinema. We hope you will come back with us and talk more about horror sequels next week. But I want to remind you yet again that you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at facebook.com/massaworm or on Twitter at massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM.
Excellent. Well, you can find me on Twitter at BriarGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. And you can also find me at oneofus.net. I'm also...
Is that your home away from home?
It is my home away from home, as is RageSelect.com. I'm on a number of video game playthroughs over there. Although, to this day, I don't know why, because I'm not very good at video games. But there you have it. But yeah, that's going to do it for this week's show. And just want to remind you that not a huge undertaking, just a little thing that we suggest going forward. Never, ever sleep again.